All right, great. Okay. Now, before I start, I've been asked to make a very important announcement that the Department of Anatomy is accepting bodies. So, should you want to donate your body, I am the spokesperson apparently for this. They will collect your body, I'm told, within 48 hours and whisk it away to the cadaver lab. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about that as well tonight, my own experiences with that. I also just want to say what an honor it is to be speaking at the Dittrich Museum, and I have to thank Jim as well as Brandy for making that happen. And I want to thank you all for coming out on Halloween, foregoing trick-or-treaters and costume parties to be here, locked in here with me, well, maybe not locked, but with these gruesome images I'm about to show you. And some of you have come very far. I know Jen has come 6 hours or more in the car, so I really, really appreciate that. You know, I used to drag my grandmother from cemetery to cemetery hunting ghosts. Some people might say that I was always obsessed with death, but I'd like to think that I was always fascinated with the past, and specifically with the people who lived in that past. I often say that I never feel more alive than when I'm standing amongst the rows and rows of anatomical specimens at Bart's Pathology Museum in London, pictured here, where I've done a lot of my research, and I just filmed a documentary called Medicine's Dark Secrets, which I'll be talking about a little later on. In one jar floats an ulcerated stomach. In another, the hands of a man who committed suicide. Cabinets are filled with syphilitic skulls, arthritic joints, and cancerous bones. The unborn sit alongside the aged. Murderers occupy the same space as the murdered. The first time that I ever touched death, I was 7 years old, and my great aunt Evelyn had passed away of a heart attack at the age of 84. That's her on the right, and she's with my great aunt Claire. And I love this picture. It's from the 1930s. Their whole lives are ahead of them. And at the time, I was living with my grandmother, who very much believed that children shouldn't be shielded from death. And I actually very much agree with that today. Although to all you young parents, let this be an example of how morbid your kid might grow up to be. She expected me to go to the wake where the body was embalmed and laid out and to interact with friends and family who had come to pay their last respects. And I remember entering that funeral home and I congregated in the back with my cousins. And eventually we whipped up enough courage to make that long walk towards the casket. Do you ever notice that a lot of dramatic moments in life have equally dramatic walks, weddings, funerals, lectures? And it was quite daunting because it involved a dead body in a very, very different context. And when I reached that casket, I remember peeking in. And to my 7-year-old eyes, my Aunt Evelyn looked more or less the same. The embalmer had done a good job. But then my cousin Beth asked if I wanted to touch her. Well, I was 7 years old, I was a child, I was curious. Although I don't think that this is really childish curiosity, I think we're all curious about death, even into adulthood. It's one of the most important relationships we're going to have. And some of you have probably come here tonight because you're curious about death. You knew I was going to show images. So, of course, I wanted to touch her. And I remember reaching a hand in and touching hers. And it was cold and it was hard like marble. And I know that sounds really cliche, but that's how I remember it. And I also remember that before that point, I didn't really understand what it meant to be dead. I knew something had changed, but I wasn't quite sure what. But when I touched her hand, I knew that something had changed forever. 10 years later, I was in a high school biology class, and we were given an opportunity to go visit a cadaver lab. And we all piled in the bus, and we went to this lab. The first thing that hit me, and something that I remember very vividly, is that smell. And I know a lot of you out there tonight will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's a very specific smell that comes with the cadaver lab. And it's not something I can really describe because it's very chemical. It's not something that can be replicated in nature necessarily. But I do remember it very vividly. And I'm going to return to that smell a little bit later. Don't worry, we're going to get into advanced decomposition and all that good stuff. But I also remember that there was a bunch of tables, and all of the tables were empty except for one at the front. And it had a body on it, which was covered in a crisp white sheet, the kind that you might find in a hospital or even a hotel. And the pathologist began to prepare us for what we were about to see, because, of course, a lot of us had never seen a dead body before. And for those of us who had seen a dead body, like myself, it was in a very different context. You have to understand that with death, it's always about context. At a funeral, we're focusing on the individual characteristics that make us a person. Why did we love them? What will we remember most about them? But in a medical laboratory, we're focusing on the general characteristics that make us all human, our anatomy. And in that way, it can be a very unsettling experience because the individuality is pulled back. We all gathered towards the front, and eventually the pathologist asked for a volunteer. Well, we're all 16, we're all 17, none of us want to be that person, so she picks someone. She picks me, which undermines the definition of a volunteer, but fortuitously gives me a story to tell tonight. And I went and I stood by her, and eventually she unveiled this body. And my first thought was, that doesn't look very human. And my second thought was, well, this doesn't really bother me. And my third thought was, oh my God, I'm a monster. I think a lot of medical students go through this today, and in fact, I've gone through and talked to a lot of them, and it's that idea that you become so desensitized so quickly that you almost wonder about your humanity in the cadaver lab. And that was similar to my experience. Now remember, I wasn't actually performing the dissection, the body was already dissected. The pathologist began to hand me various organs from this abdominal cavity. She handed me a heart, she handed me a liver, and it was very surreal. It almost felt like a prop. I became very comfortable, I fell into the rhythm of her lecture, and I let my eyes wander around this body. And everything had been dissected, all the tendons and all the muscles, everything was on display. And then my eyes fell on the cadaver's hands. And on her fingernails was a red, fiery nail polish. I will remember that to the day I die. I guess you can say this started a lifelong obsession with anatomy. I didn't really have the stomach to go to medical school, so I went and I did a PhD, as Brandy kindly mentioned, in the history of medicine. And it is actually a real subject. I might not have to tell this audience, but I get a lot of medical historian. Oh my God, what is that? Like I'm a, you know, exotic creature let out of its cage. But a lot of people don't know that it's an actual subject. It's something that's studied quite profusely, especially in the UK, where they have a lot of money to develop programs like that. And it was the perfect degree for me because it combined my love of the past with my love of medical science. And about a year ago, The Lancet approached me and they wanted me to write something to give their readers a better idea of what the dissection room was like in the past. Now, I thought about how I might do this. I mean, I only had 2 pages and I could have just written a purely historical piece. But what I really wanted to do was I wanted to collect the memories of medics today about their first experiences in that cadaver lab. And I wanted to weave those into stories about the past, because I think that really gives a clearer view of how different it was, but also, in surprising ways, how similar it could be as well. So I'm just going to give you a little bit flavor for this because I want you to get a better idea also of the kind of thing that I was trying to film for Medicine's Dark Secrets, which I will get to at the very end. Now, the idea of weaving the contemporary with the past really came from a conversation I had with my mother, who's a registered nurse just outside of Chicago. And I asked her one day, "Mom, tell me about your first dissection." And she said, "I remember it well. I remember that the woman was in her 30s, younger than I was at the time. I felt bad for her. And I wanted to cover her body with a blanket. Not because she was naked. I don't know. I just thought she'd be more comfortable. More comfortable before we began poking, prodding, and pulling her to pieces. It was that moment I wanted to capture. That idea that we have to overcome something in ourselves, a humanity, so to speak, in order to cut into a dead body. Now, the idea that dissection or the anatomization of a body is tantamount to distorting or hacking is something that comes up often in the history records. In 1663, you have the Danish physician Thomas Bartholin, who wrote that one must partake in the mangling of the dead in order to know the living. A century later, the master of the barber surgeon's company said that he doubted those around him would ever forget this miserable, mangled object. That word mangle comes up time and again in the historical record. Now, some of you may be familiar with this. This is Hogarth. This is actually the last of four panels that he does. And what's happening in the previous panels is there's this fictitious guy named Tom Nero, and it starts with the first one when he's a young boy and he's torturing dogs, and it gets progressively worse where he ends up murdering his lover in the third panel. And in this one, he's been executed and he's being publicly dissected, which was an additional form of punishment in the 18th century. But the reason why I picked this was because these surgeons, these anatomists, they certainly look like they're mangling the dead. And they're kind of portrayed in this animalistic way that they're relishing in this. And surgeons and anatomists in the past were very aware of public opinion about themselves. And they were concerned about this as well. Unlike the sterile laboratories of today, as I've described, the dead house, as it was often called, was a very different place. One medical student from the 19th century described the, quote, swarms of sparrows fighting for scraps, and the rats in the corner gnawing bleeding vertebrae. The dissection theater was bloody, smelly, and filled with all kinds of animals and insects trying to feast on these decomposing bodies, some of which had been buried in the ground maybe 2 or 3 days before they end up on the anatomist's dissection table. In letters, diaries, and in records that I come across, I often see descriptions of decaying flesh, rancid corpses, and putrid stenches. Not the slightly sweet clinical smell that a lot of medics have described to me today. And I would hope that, you know, medical students today don't think of rancid corpses and putrid stenches. It's a very different process. In a letter dated the 8th of October, 1793, a young James Williams, then 16 years old, living in the famous anatomist John Hunter's house, wrote to his sister, and he said, "My room has 2 beds in it, and in point of situation is not the most pleasant in the world. The dissecting room with 6 dead bodies in it is immediately above, and that in which Mr. Hunter makes preparations is the next adjoining to it, so that you may conceive it to be a little perfumed." I think he was being kind to his sister. Oop, am I still on? I'm off? Oh no, I lost my mic. Okay. I'm going to have to come over here. I'll have to be behind the podium now. He goes on. John Hunter. Yes, this is in John Hunter's anatomy school in London. He goes on to say that there is a dead carcass just at the moment rumbling up the stairs, and the resurrection men swearing most terribly. I am informed this will be the case most mornings about 4 o'clock throughout the winter. There is something horrible in it at first, but I am now become reconciled. And that reconciliation is something I'm going to definitely return to in a few moments. Now, the 17th century German surgeon, Lorenz Heister, was not as delicate as Mr. Williams in his descriptions. He recommended that students of surgery be not only furnished with strength of body, but constancy of mind, so that they remain unmolested and unmoved by the stench, the blood, the pus, and the nastiness that will occur to them during their practice. There were plenty of young men who entered the dead house who found that they couldn't handle it. And I particularly love these guys because they're really dramatic in their descriptions. The composer Hector Berlioz, who attended medical school in Paris in 1821, leapt out of the window and fled as though death and all his hideous crew were at my heels. the first time he entered what he described as the human charnel house. Berlioz claimed that it was 24 hours before he recovered from the shock and was able to return to the dissection theater. Now, this image Jim might be more familiar with and certainly more qualified to talk about. If you don't know about his book, it's just absolutely amazing. It's a collection of early dissection photos. And I actually bought this book in London and proceeded immediately to the pub with it. And thankfully, my friends know me well enough that they weren't too shocked when I put it down. But the reason why I chose this image, it actually has nothing to do with the quote I'm about to give you, which is from the 16th century, but it does capture this idea that a lot of, in these records, you get a lot about dreams and nightmares during the first week of dissection. So Thomas Platter the Younger, a 16th century Swiss physician, was haunted by the memories of his first dissection. During the first week of his lessons, he dreamt that he had eaten and feasted upon human flesh. When he woke up, he vomited. And I know also from my experience with medics that they tend to associate the body with certain kinds of meat. They can't eat chicken. They can't eat turkey. So this idea also comes up in the past, especially this kind of association with eating the flesh or eating the body. Of course, many, however, did become acclimated to the experience, and they overcame themselves to be able to perform the dissections. Bit by bit, piece by piece, they began to view the body not as a person, but as an object. Some surgeons and physicians were even able to cut into the bodies of their relatives. The French anatomist Guillaume Rondelet caused an uproar in 1538 when he publicly dissected the body of his infant boy. And William Harvey, the very famous anatomist known for his discovery of the circulation of blood around the heart, undertook private dissections of both his father and his sister in the 16th century. And this particular illustration, this is Harvey, he's performing a dissection not specifically on a relative of his, but that is why I chose this image here. From these conversations, I discovered that many medical students are, this got me wondering about medical students today, and how did these experiences in the past compare to ones that medical students had today? And from the conversations that I had, I discovered that many medical students, unsurprisingly, are just as apprehensive about confronting a cadaver for the first time as people were in the past. Dr. Erica Lilly, a general practitioner in Canada, remembers her unease as the cadaver's head was unwrapped from its plastic covering during her first anatomy lesson. The face did not look human, she said, as much as it looked like a mask. Similarly, Jennifer Kasten, research fellow at the Department of Surgery of the University of California, Los Angeles, recalls the muffled crying from some of her fellow students as the body bags were unzipped for the very first time. She describes the first cut as one of, quote, quiet and awed intensity. For her, it was an initiation into the mysteries of medicine. Now, the physical act of cutting into a dead body was only one obstacle that medics talked about. There was that smell as well. Thomas Waite, specialty registrar in public health in Wales, remembers it vividly as I do. He said, "I'll never forget the smell. At the end of the year, I threw away the only set of clothes I wore under my dissection coat because no amount of washing could ever get rid of it." The sensory experiences of those practicing dissection today were very different from those in the past. And I really wanted to kind of get a better idea of this. One day, I was talking to my friend William Macleyhose, Bill Macleyhose, who is a medical historian at UCL in London, and it randomly came up that he's American and that he had had an opportunity to go onto the body farm. Now, for those of you who don't know what the body farm is, it's a research facility in Tennessee where they lay bodies out in varying conditions outdoors, and they study the rate of decomposition. This is done for forensic research as well as some other types of research going on. And he had an opportunity to go visit. And so I said, well, you have to tell me about this. And actually, it took quite a bit of urging to get a quote from him, because it was one of those experiences that was quite traumatic to him. He said, he struggled to find words, pointing out that words will always have some level of distance to them that cannot fully capture the raw and horrific experience he had when he first visited the research facility. He confessed that the safe, stale academic references he had in his mind before his visit was no preparation for the reality he faced. "I remember wishing I hadn't gone," he admitted. That the body farm to me is more akin to sort of the experiences that people may have been having in the past, at least as far as decomposition. Because remember, again, the bodies of today are very different. They're preserved, they're cold, and in the past the smells would have been different. There would have been blood involved, there would have been all kinds of bodily fluids. And I think that the body farm, that experience, that confrontation with decomposition that most of us never get exposed to, is probably more similar to some of the types of things that would have ended up on the anatomist dissection table in the past. The realities facing the young surgical student in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries was very different and very grim. These were not the bloodless bodies of today, with their preserved limbs and their starched linens. Indeed, Dr. Kasten told me that she found the lack of particular smells in the dissection room to be very surprising. Even when slicing open the colon and squeezing out the long, toothpaste-like stream of feces, she was not met with the familiar human smells that one might expect. And Jennifer Kasten is actually a surgeon now, and she says that she finds the smells in the surgical room to be more disturbing than the ones, or more human, I should say, than the ones that were she was confronted with in the cadaver lab. And of course, today, cadavers are largely anonymous. Yet I was surprised by the frequency by which questions about the cadaver's former identity came up in my interviews with these medical students, or medics. Dr. Lilly remembers the first time she looked upon the feet of her cadaver. She wondered if those feet had ever walked upon the beach, if those toes had ever felt sand between them. Similarly, Dr. Wade often thinks back to the elderly man he dissected during anatomy lessons. The man really belied his age. Wade remembers being struck that one can achieve great age with so little evidence of disease after death. 12 years later, he still had questions. Had this man walked with a cane or unaided? Did he maintain his independence, or was he mentally more frail in life than his physical organs appeared in death? I believe these questions speak less about the dead than they do about the living. Focusing on the humanity of the corpse sometimes serves as a distraction from one's own sense of inhumanity as a dissector. It's a small comfort to those faced with the task of opening up a dead body. Jennifer said, "We worried there was something defective about us, that we were so easily able to go up cutting into a person in a methodological, emotionless way. After all," she said, "our normal was really very abnormal." Now, for the last part here, I'm going to see if I can get this mic on again. So, excuse me, this looks a little sketchy. I'm going to see. It might have just turned off. Nope, I'm going to be stuck behind here. Can everybody hear me? Maybe I need to move this up a little bit here. Yeah? Okay. So, now that I've given you an idea of what the past was like, I want to talk to you a little bit about this documentary that I just finished filming in London called Medicine's Dark Secrets. The questions that I set out to answer in this documentary are simply, who ends up on the dissection table in the 18th and 19th centuries, and why do they end up there? And there's, of course, various groups. There's criminals. The poor obviously end up there. The deformed, there was a huge interest in deformities. Suicides sometimes end up in the hands of the anatomists. These are the kinds of groups that we looked at. But I think that I've probably given you enough history for tonight. So I think a really nice way to round this up is not to talk any more about the history, because you can watch the show at some point, hopefully, but to rather talk to you about my emotional response to some of the specimens that we filmed and why I think it's very, very important that these objects remain on display despite the fact that they are also very controversial. And some of what I'm about to say might brush you the wrong way. I welcome that discussion and those arguments, and everybody's going to have a very different opinion about this. Now, the object that probably elicited the strongest response from me was this. This is the body of a 9-year-old child. It's early 19th century. It's been shellacked, which is an unusual way to prepare a specimen. Now, it's not the age of this child that bothered me, because you have to remember that our association with death and old age is a very modern phenomenon. Children were exposed to an array of deadly and dangerous diseases in the past, and I often come across specimens belonging to young children. So it wasn't really the age of the child that bothered me. But I think it had partly to do with this dramatic pose. As you can see, the head has been thrown back. The vascular system is on display. All the arteries, all the veins. And it's a wonderful prep, and we know that it would have been used as a medical teaching tool because it does so thoroughly show the vascular system. But there's also a bit of showmanship involved here. It kind of like the Von Hagens exhibit in Body Worlds. Some of you may know and have been to that, and will surely have opinions about that as well. But in this case, it's kind of like the anatomist is showing off a little bit, that he can do this prep, that it's a very complicated prep, and so here we have it. When the cameras began rolling and I asked Carla Valentine, the curator of Bart's Pathology Museum, where this object is housed, I asked her probably the question maybe that's on your minds, which is, who is this boy and how does he end up in the hands of the surgeons? And her answer was, we don't know. Unfortunately, that's something that medical historians and curators that deal with these kinds of objects come across all the time. Now, it's likely that this body was obtained illegally, perhaps through body snatching. Again, we don't know. It could have been procured in a different way. The records could have been lost. It's likely that there probably was no record about this prep. But here we have it. We have this boy. We have him in this dramatic pose, and he's on display to the public, to anybody who would like to come in and see him. And in this way, because we don't know anything about him, that can be a little unsettling for the viewer. But again, I'm going to return to this in a minute, why I think it's very important that these objects remain on display. The next object I want to talk about, which we also filmed, I want to tell you a story about a little girl named Carolyn. And Carolyn was born in the early 19th century, and she was born with a form of dwarfism that made her very small, but perfectly proportional. And because of that, she was a curiosity. Her family moved from Sicily to Ireland, and she contracted consumption, tuberculosis. And her family brought in a surgeon, and the surgeon suggested that he take little Carolyn to London to cure her of her consumption, to get her into the cleaner air of London. I think that probably should have been a clue that there was something a little sketchy going on. But her family agreed, and little Carolyn traveled to London. Now, unfortunately, the surgeon ended up parading her around the city and making her perform before hundreds of spectators, including the king himself. Little Carolyn's life is very sad, and her death is probably even sadder. She ends up dying before hundreds of spectators one day. Now, I don't want you to think that she would have survived, because she wouldn't have. I mean, she would have certainly succumbed to her disease at some point. But it's a very sad end, and it doesn't end there. The surgeon, the opportunist, decided that he wanted to make just a little bit more money off Carolyn. So he sold her body to a man named Sir Everett Hume. Hume, at the time in London, was known to have a great interest in anatomical abnormalities. So he bought this body and he dissected it very, very happily. And he recorded his observations in notes that you can actually still see at the Royal College of Surgeons in London. So if you're interested, and that's also available online as well. So after this, you can ask me where I get all this stuff. A lot of it is digitalized, which is fantastic. At the same time, little Carolyn's death was reported in the newspapers because she was quite famous in her own right. And her father found out about this, and he rushed to London to claim her body. But he was too late. Her body had already been dissected, the flesh had been boiled off, and Sir Everard Hume was now in ownership of Carolyn. This skeleton is now on display at the Hunterian Collection at the Royal College of Surgeons in London. You can go into this collection for free, and you can see a lot of fascinating objects. This one in particular, we did film, and we told little Carolyn's story for Medicine's Dark Secrets. She's the one in the middle, and she's propped next to a skeleton of a child reportedly the same age, so you can really see how small she actually was. This is a really sad story. And again, sometimes knowing the stories behind the specimens makes it even more unsettling when we consider that they're on display. Now, I don't want you to walk away tonight thinking I only look at whole bodies, because actually that's quite rare. Most of what I look at are disembodied body parts floating in jars. So this one is a particular favorite. This is at Surgeons Hall in Edinburgh. This is a compound fracture leading to amputation in the early 19th century. I'm happy to report that this person who owned this arm at one point went on to lead a very healthy life, or as healthy as one could live in the early 19th century. But I picked this particular specimen because, again, I wanted to illustrate that when one is the viewer of these objects, it can be unsettling. But sometimes when it's a heart or a brain or some kind of object like that, we feel removed. And it might not be as unsettling as when you see a hand, kind of harking back to that first dissected body I saw with the fingernail polished. I feel like you can't look at hands and help but wonder about the person whom it once belonged to. This is another hand, a closer view. This is at Bart's Pathology Museum in London. It has been dissected and is floating in a jar. And all of these objects are on display and open to the public. Now, there are a lot of people who believe, and some of those people might be here tonight, they believe that these specimens should be buried or reburied in some cases if they were stolen by body snatchers, or at the very least they should be locked behind closed doors away from the voyeuristic view of a curious public. And we could do all those things. And in some cases, we have done those things, maybe not necessarily reburying, but locking away certain specimens because they're controversial. And while we can do that, my view is it doesn't change the past. These things happened, and medicine owes a great debt to these people. It's through the deaths of this person, or this person, this person, or this person, that many, many, many lives have been saved. There is a saying that we die three deaths in our lives. The first is when our bodies die. The second is when our bodies are consigned to the grave, or we're cremated, or our bodies are disposed of. And the third is when sometime in the not so distant future, our names are spoken for the very last time. If you pardon the pun, I like to think that through the documentary, and through the website, and through the work of medical historians who are trying to tell these stories, we are resurrecting the past by speaking these people's names again, by sharing their stories, and by providing them a legacy hopefully they would be proud of. Thank you.
So much, Lindsay. We have a little time now, and I wondered if you had questions. that you would like to ask the Surgeon's Apprentice before we go upstairs for the reception. So if you have questions, please ask.
And also, just a lot of people ask me this. I just pronounce it the surgeon. It's not the chirurgian. It's, in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have used that when I started the website, but I didn't think anybody would actually read the website, so here I am with the awkward spelling. May I have questions? Yep. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, would you like to go? Yes, we do have, there are women in these collections. Now I'm trying to think if we covered some specifically in Medicine's Dark Secrets. Murderers, regardless of gender, would end up...
I don't mean on the table. I mean doing the dissection.
Oh, doing the dissection. Not in the period that I'm looking at. I look mostly at early modern, 17th, 18th century. I'm heading towards the 19th century, but it's not my specialty, and I think Jim might be able to answer that, but I haven't specifically come across women doing it. Although, there are some early dissection photos I've come across of women. I know they're in existence, but that's a little bit beyond my period, so not in this show. Oh, sorry.
So I'm curious to hear your thoughts coming from not a physician's perspective on the utility and the utilization today and tomorrow of teaching medical students anatomy in the dissection lab.
That was,
because I am coming to the opinion, being involved with a lot of issues with building a new medical school building and dealing with curriculums, that teaching anatomy the way we do today is a little different than the way we've taught anatomy in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. And it's no longer necessary for a variety of reasons. So you look back historically into an educational development that basically was driven by a little of purient interest, utilitarianism, learning anatomy to be able to treat patients. And it baffles me why we're still doing it. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that you bring up some good points. In the past, dissection wasn't just about learning about anatomy. It was, of course, about practice, because these surgeons would have been performing operations on living people who were not anesthetized, and it was much easier to learn how to amputate a limb, for instance, on a dead body that's not screaming in pain. And so it did serve a purpose that perhaps is antiquated today, because we can anesthetize a patient. My personal view, though, is that the dissection is much more than just a learning process about anatomy and medicine, and that it's an experience with interacting with a dead body, and that there's a value in that. Like I said, it was a very vivid experience, and I didn't perform the dissection, but the people that I interviewed, the medics today, always remember that as a critical and crucial point. Maybe not because they learned something in particular, but it was that sort of initiation into medicine. It was understanding, interacting with that dead body. So I would kind of hate to see it go on the wayside, although I understand in a practical sense, it may not have as much of a purpose as it did in the past.
If that was the case, why is it that you showed a picture that was rather disturbing with corpses propped up around the student lying on the table, and the hundreds of postcards out of the Edmondson book that really shows absolutely no respect?
Well, you have to remember, those photographs are a moment in time.
Okay.
And
but you said that this is where the student gains respect for the body.
I think it's the medics today have described it as an initiation into medicine. Every person I interviewed remembered that with some kind of respect. Now, I know that there are all of these 19th century photographs. Of course, you saw one in the lecture. And that's a moment in time. It's not necessarily their first reaction. It's not necessarily their last reaction to this experience. And of course, this is a way of detaching. It's part of the detachment process to get away from the realities, again, of dissection. And like I said at the beginning, I really feel that people have to sort of overcome something within themselves in order to cut into the dead body. And it's part of that discovering about yourself that you can either prove to yourself that you can do it, which is probably an important thing to a young medic, in the discovery of the anatomy and the body itself. These are all things that I personally think are valuable, but again, I understand that they might not have necessarily a practical application today when going into medicine. But I would welcome, you know, to open up that discussion to people. I'm going to call my friend Andy here. He's just, you know, first year medical student. Do you think that right here in the front row trying to freak me out, do you find this experience valuable beyond just sort of the anatomy that you would learn?
To be frank, extraordinarily so, yes. And the reasons for that may be a little bit different, and you know, obviously this conversation, this presentation was in historical context, but just from a perspective of reverence for life, period, the fact that the donor was willing to provide the body that I'm now learning on gives me the opportunity to carry forward that person's legacy in the future, to do good for thousands of other people just in that one person's sacrifice. So if for no other reason, you know, I like thinking of it from a perspective of reverence like that. Now, perhaps an interesting contrast to the point that you just made. When I saw the photo of the plate of the student on the table with the corpses around him, my interpretation of that photo was not one of disrespect, but rather one of the burst of the student having to come to grips with the fact that they're confronting a very morbid situation that can be very daunting for a lot of people. You know, I can relate the very stories that my friend Dr. Pinceras here, you know, said to. Or told you about friends of hers talking about their first experience with dissection. Muffled cries, a bit of nerves when it comes to actually putting your hands on the body. And those things are all very real. I just experienced them myself 2 months ago. You know, people still come to terms with this every day. The smell is very haunting. But most importantly, I think having an understanding of the sheer physicality of the human body, when a lot of people really can't get that any other way than by doing a physical dissection and performing that, understanding where the heart is, where the great vessels are, how everything relates together, that's of invaluable importance to any medical education, in my opinion, from my perspective.
Yeah, and I would agree with the idea of the detachment in those photos. And again, Jim is really the expert on what's going on there. But the situation can be so grim that you do often find these kinds of things. I would love to write a piece actually on sort of games and pranks that are played in the dissection room in the past. I don't know if these are true, actually. A lot of them, I think, are stories that come about, and they're ways to remove oneself again from the situation and kind of like boasting a little bit that, you know, I'm not at all grossed out by this, and it's part of that detachment process. So thank you for that. Yes.
Speaking from the perspective of merely a college biology class, if there was a model of a particular organ in the room and the real thing, there was much more student interest in the real thing.
Yes, yeah.
And I know that some people simply could not grasp from a model the actual tissue. On a test, if they had learned it on a model, if they were confronted on a test with
Yeah, and I feel the same way about history in general. I think it's really important, and that's why the Dittrich collection is fantastic, because it's one thing to read about these things in books, but it's an entirely different experience to see the objects, which you're going to see at the reception tonight, or to see the specimens. I always tell people I sort of live and die with the stories of these people, because they were real, and they suffered and went through unimaginable pain sometimes. So interacting in a historical sense as well with real objects is important. And I can imagine, not being a medical student, that that would be an important experience to do a dissection. Yes, oh, sorry, you one back there, and then you next. Yeah.
Just hearing the conversation, I know we live in a culture that has a lot of fear surrounding death. So I'm wondering, in your interviews, if you found that after people were in the dissection lab, that their perception of end of life and death were changed because of that.
Hmm. No, that's a really interesting question, and it, unfortunately, it's not one that I actually explored too much, but the Lancet article was written over a year ago, and I have since, for people who maybe have been following this website, The Surgeon's Apprentice, I have since gotten more into sort of the death scene, I guess you can call it, about just those kinds of issues, and in confronting fear about death. Now, some people think that, you know, being young, you can't talk about these issues because you can't possibly understand. I think that a dialogue about death is an incredibly important one, and we should, and anybody and everybody should be talking about it. I'd love to go back to these medics and maybe explore something like that. Did it change? Did it make it less scary? I know that my interaction with my Aunt Evelyn certainly made, in a way, death less scary to me. I had seen the body, and I understood that she was no longer there, and I knew that something had changed, as I said. And that was really powerful message for me as a 7-year-old child, which is why I think that children shouldn't be shielded from death, but of course be engaged with it in a special discourse and a special dialogue.
Did you come across any, what I would say, upper class individuals who had, you know, other than doctors and medical personnel, that were essentially maybe seeking fame through donating their bodies? I mean, you kind of addressed that.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people think, I mean, this is going to be in the show, a lot of people think that these bodies are the bodies of the poor, and by and large they are. Medicine owes a great debt to the poor, but I do come across sometimes people who donated their bodies. Like, my favorite is the Bishop of Durham, and his rectum is in the Hunterian collection. And what happened was, he came to John Hunter, the famous anatomist, and he thought he had piles, and Hunter said, you have rectal cancer. The bishop didn't believe him, went on to seek various cures, and he did, in the end, recognize that he was dying, accepted that, and his body ended up in the hands of Hunter. Now, there's no real concept of consent in this period that I'm talking about in the 18th century. However, he was so famous that there was no way that people didn't know that Hunter had this body. So clearly his family had given their consent to for him to do the autopsy and for him to preserve this. The other thing is, Hunter actually opened his collection to the public. I think it was like once a month. And he labeled everything. So it would have said the Bishop of Durham's rectum. There was no secret here that he was in this collection. So you do come across, there's another great story of a coachman. I love this story. He ends up getting an aneurysm behind his knee because he's wearing these high leather riding boots in the 18th century. Again, he ends up with Hunter. Hunter's kind of everywhere in this period. And Hunter does a very radical and dangerous surgery where he cuts off the blood supply to the aneurysm rather than amputating. And that coachman was so grateful that his leg was preserved, because of course his livelihood was attached to his ability to drive his cab, that he gave his body over. There's a letter in the Hunterian collection where he says he wants Hunter to have his body should he die before Hunter, and his leg is actually in that collection right now. So stories about the Sicilian fairy and some of these other kind of sad stories are also balanced off with stories that can be quite surprising about the 18th century people giving their bodies over. And I love those, and those definitely make it into the documentary. Oh, I don't know if the music... No. I'm not involved so heavily in... The question is, can you tell us about a specimen that was so controversial that it's not on display right now? I don't know at this current moment. There is a very controversial specimen at the Hunterian, and some of you may have heard of him. His name's the Irish Giant. He is on display, but I think in various times he's been taken off display, and then he's back. And he's huge. He's 7'10" tall, hence the name the Irish Giant. And Hunter wanted his body and approached him in life and said, "When you die, can I have your body?" And Charles Byrne, the Irish Giant, said no. And he was so terrified of being dissected that he wanted to be buried at sea. Unfortunately, his friends were paid off, and there was a coffin buried at sea, but it was full of rocks, and Charles Byrne's body ends up with Hunter. Hunter knew, even at the time, he actually didn't put the Irish Giant on display for a few years because he even knew that it was going to be controversial. But it is on display right now, but it is one of those objects that gets a lot of attention. And if you go into the Hunterian, don't ask him about it, because like everybody comes in to see him, and he's right there, you know, his story's right there. But I think they think, well, there's a lot of other specimens here that are just as fascinating, quite frankly, and have similar stories like Carolyn's. But he gets a lot of attention because he is one of very few that's sort of on record as saying he didn't want to be dissected and does end up dissected. So look for him, the Irish Giant. He kind of appears here and there in the news, and people ask for him to be reburied. So I saw another hand go up. Oh, yep.
I've always wondered why there was so much taboo around dissection, because when past centuries, since it was so common for people to die, you would have thought that they would be more comfortable with death. Figure out how to prolong life? Is it because the surgeons had such a bad reputation, or because there was a reverence?
Well, people in the past, you have to remember, a lot of them had a physical conception of the afterlife, that there would be a bodily resurrection, and they would have wanted their bodies to stay intact. Also, in England, and that's where my expertise is, and this develops differently in various countries, but in England specifically, there was the Murder Act, which meant that murderers were dissected, and it was, so dissection became associated with punishment, and it was very, very hard to break that association, so for that reason as well. In fact, at the public execution scenes, you see the crowds, and the crowds loved an execution, but they really got angry at the anatomists who were there to collect the bodies, and these fights would break out, and people would, you know, end up breaking their arm trying to collect these bodies, and you get great descriptions in the past. So the public themselves thought, okay, this person has paid enough, and that should be it. So I think it's a complicated answer, but it does, certainly has to do with religious beliefs at the time and that association with murder and dissection.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much, Lindsay.